Never been. I don't think I have. I've been hit, and I never have been beaten. Mm-hmm. I think it wasn't too much beating then, because I think the pitchers had good enough control at that time. They'd throw at you, but they would throw.
Yeah.
They would push you back. They wouldn't actually try to hit you in the head. Anyway, it's pretty tough to hit a guy in the head when he's a little kid. That doesn't happen very often.
42, the Browns finished third. Pretty good for them.
Yes.
They'd only been in one pennant race in their existence. That was 1922.
Since 1922.
And then the following year, 43, I realized the war was going on, but at the home opener, the Browns fans were so excited that 4,000 of them showed up.
Isn't that something? That we played, we were never bothered by crap. we could always get to and from the ballpark at any time.
Mm-hmm.
No, the Browns were so enthused about it because we had finished in third in 19. Yeah. They came back in 43, and we didn't draw it. I think they drew less than 300,000 people the whole year, I believe. I mean, something like that. Anyway, in fact, the matter is in 44 even, we didn't draw real good then, until the very last of the season.
Yeah, sold out the last game, even with, we'll talk about that later, but I guess the four games against the Yankees,
yes.
The first day drew 6,100 people. I mean, yeah. Here the Browns are fighting for the...
That's right.
And nobody showed. I'm sure that had part, some of it had to do with the war, but a lot of it had to do with the fact that the Cardinals were...
That's right, The Cardinals were always the favorites in St. Louis. I tell you this, though, The Browns fans themselves came from the city itself, within the city limits. And the Cardinals fans came from out around, because the Cardinals had a radio network, and they broadcast out the little towns, 100 miles around there. And they became Cardinal fans. Of course, they hear the names all the time. And so, really, the hardcore people in St. Louis, they were old Browns fans, because the St. Louis Cardinals, I mean, Browns were there before the Cardinals. And that's where they came. And so we didn't get many fans from outside of St. Louis,
yeah.
Like the Cardinals did.
A couple weeks ago, I had a little talk with Bob Kane. And he played for the Browns there at the end of his career, and I can't remember, I was doing the research on him, and I can't remember the player, but it was 52 or 53, one of the players had said that the Browns fans were very, very, they never got on the players, they never rode the Browns players and never called them names and stuff, and this ball player thought it was the fact that the players had the crowd outnumbered.
Well, that could be. They was afraid to, but that very well could be it, yeah.
Now, during the war, they had all sorts of travel restrictions, so the Browns had their spring training where?
In Cape Girardeau, Missouri. In Cape Girardeau, because we were the farthest south in Cape Girardeau. Mm-hmm. It's about 100 miles south of St. Louis. We trained there, and it's still cold, but...
What was the facility? Was it a...
Yes. The facility, they had a ball field. Mm-hmm. I mean, but
was it a college type?
It's a college, yeah. And they used there was a college field house. And what they did, they brought in about 6 inches of dirt in that field house, and we could take batting practice with nets, and we could take fielding practice. It wasn't big enough for an infield, but we could take fielding practice on ground, on dirt. And it really was, it turned out to be a good facility. Of course, we could go outside and do our running and, train off. If it wasn't too bad, we'd go outside and probably play a little bit or use the infield there. But most generally, we stayed in this dormer in the field house,
mm-hmm.
at the Cape Girardeau College.
Who was Teddy Atkinson?
Teddy Atkinson, he was a young man that here. He lived just about 15 miles from here, and I knew his daddy very well, and he loved to play baseball, and he was a pretty good young high school kid. Well, he wasn't hit. He was still in school.
I think he was 14.
So they said, well, bring his spring training. At that time, you could sign anybody. You know, I mean, there wasn't any baseball restrictions that you couldn't sign.
Yeah, I think that was the year that Nuxall pitched, and he was on
the 50. I think so. Yeah, I think it was. And so I said, okay. But his dad said, well, he can go to spring training, but I want his school. I said, okay, you take his, give me his books. We'll take his books, and I'll see that he studies. I'm not much of a teacher, but I mean, I'll be his teacher. And so we took all of his books, and the teacher would send assignments, and I would see that he would make assignments, and I took care of them. And I guess I was his tutor.
Mm-hmm.
He used that word very loosely, but I did teach him, and I took him there, and he played pretty good, but he just wasn't quite, you know, you kid that young and going into major leagues, and it gets too tough for him.
Mm-hmm. The Browns started the season, I want to get this right, I think there were 13 guys on the roster that were 4F?
Probably so, I don't know that number. Mm-hmm. But they probably was.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what was the reason that you weren't in the service?
There's two reasons. My knees were bad. I'd had bad knees, and they my knee would come out, I mean, it would flop out on me. And I couldn't move it, I'd have to get back in shape, and, you know. And then too, I had some internal problem. I had when I examined, I had albumin in my urine and a couple of things that really didn't harm it too much, but they didn't want me. Fact of the matter is, Bertie Tibbetts was down in Texas somewhere, and he called me one day and wanted to know if I was going to service. Come down there. He wanted me to play on his baseball, you know, out of the camps having baseball. And I said, sure. So but then they wouldn't take me. And then also Johnny Mize and somebody else, Bob Feller, I think was it, Great Lakes.
Naval,
yeah.
Yeah.
And I wanted to, and I couldn't, and they wouldn't take me in the service for that, because my service, they had already, I was going to play two or three different places. Go play ball in the service, but
So the Browns started off the 44 season. They won their first nine games.
And
how many of those were at home? Were all of them at home, or
no? There was some on the road. I know some was in Chicago.
Yeah, but I know the one. Once again, those nutty Brown fans. I was doing research on this, and I guess the seventh game. When you win your seventh in a row, attracted 960 people. Just amazing.
Isn't that something? But the Browns never did draw very well. I mean, I think the year that we won the pennant, that in 44, I think we only drew 450,000 or some, and probably 150,000 of them was in the last few days.
Yeah.
But when Luke Sewell kept telling us in Cape Girardeau, said, now we can win this thing. If you just stay with us and we all bear down, we play together. He kept pounding it into us. You can win this pennant. We can win this pennant. And we did, and we started out good. And see, I told you we could win a pennant. And we got the idea right then that we were going to win.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it carried through. Because even during the season, we'd have a little slump or something. Don't worry, we'll get straightened out. We'd have a little meeting. Let's get straightened out here. We got to win this pennant. And we never gave up. We were tough to beat.
Mm-hmm.
We really were. I think in the month of September in 44, I think we were in and out of first place four or five times. I mean, we'd drop back a game or two and then get back to winning and win again and get back. I think it was four or five times that we dropped out of first place and yet came back again in first place.
Mm-hmm. Where'd the Browns come up with Sig Jakuki?
Sig was quite a character. He's a character, one of the characters of all characters. He was different.
Mm-hmm.
Sig, he was pitching. He had served in the Marines and had been discharged out of the Marines. I think he was a Marine. 6 or 8 years or something, long time, and he was discharged. And he was playing ball around Galveston, Texas. And one of our scouts saw him down there and said, let's sign him, because he, three or four reasons, he could pitch. He had a good arm. He could pitch. Plus the fact that he would not be bothered by the war, because he's already served his time. He's not a 4F. He just served his time out. And he came up there and started and pitched for him. He was a good pitcher. He really was. But his addicts off the field were a little bit to be desired.
With the booze.
Yeah. He really loved to drink. And he loved to drink and fight. And as long as we kept him healthy, he could win. There was times, I know George McQuinn one time during the middle of the season, I'm done. George McQuinn, which never says very much anyway, and Chikuki had pitched a good ball game, say on a Tuesday, I think, or something like that. And after the ball game, McQuinn started out, well, we'll see you Friday. That's about what it was.
He was gone till then.
And it was, we got to the fact that we all accepted him as he was. And if he pitched a good ball game on Tuesday, if he didn't show up till Thursday or Friday, nobody said anything. Yeah. I mean, that was okay. But I'll tell you one thing, when it comes his time to pitch, he was on the mound and pitched. And he was a tough competitor.
He won 13-14.
Yeah, he would beat you. He would, you know, he was scared of nobody. He would challenge every hitter. He'd throw that ball. He threw strikes all the time. He didn't back off from anybody or nothing. He kind of set the pace for some of the rest of them too. Said, "Hey, I just dare you." He threw that ball. Just dare him to hit it. They didn't hit too good either.
Do you remember when Hubbard threw Potter out of the game for supposedly throwing spitballs?
Yes. Everybody was accusing Potter of throwing spitballs. And also, I was trying to think of the pitcher, of the Yankees. I can't remember his name. We accused him of throwing. So Sewell accused him of throwing them. And Fletcher from the Yankees was accused Potter throwing the ball. Well, you know how that. So he went out and warned. Hubbard came out and warned Potter the second time. And I'm not so sure that Potter didn't wet one once in a while. But anyway, and he accused him of it. And he said, now next time I'm going to throw you out of the ball game. Now, I warned you twice. And so evidently he thought he threw another spitter. And so he threw him out of the ball game and suspended him for 10 days. Mm. Well, the funny part about that was Potter didn't win the pitch, so he went home. And 9 months later, his son was born. And he named him Cal Hubbard. His name was Cal. Potter always said, no, he didn't name him for that. But everybody suggested that he did. Mm-hmm. And Potter laughs about it. Yeah. That's what happened. It hurt us because Potter couldn't pitch for 10 days.
They said that, well, unlike most umpires, I guess that Cal Hubbard had pretty good vision. I guess they tested him and his vision was like 20/10. I guess it was even better, statistically anyway, than Williams.
Yeah. Well, Potter, I mean, that I don't know for that for sure, but then I'm sure that happened because he was a good umpire, but he was a tough old, but he was very fair umpire. I mean, he didn't... what he said was true. What he said something, that was it. Period. Mm-hmm. Bam. You know, there was no doubt about it.
What happened late in the year? Who was this Tom Turner that you guys played with? He got in a fight Washington?
Catcher. Tom came over to us. And at that time, Washington had they had more Puerto Rican players than any other team. And there was always controversy among it, your spick and all that sort of stuff, opinion. and this Tom Turner and them, it happened that they were in St. Louis, and Turner was sitting on the bench before the game. I mean, they were taking batting practice. We were all up, most of us up changing shirts or something in the clubhouse. And word got out, hey, come on down. Somebody, in fact, I was sitting on, I just came downstairs and I started fighting. I went back and said, hey, we need help. Come on, you know, we all need. And though he had challenged this big, I forget his name.
Roberto Ortiz.
Roberto Ortiz. And he was a big guy too, and Turner was a big guy. And he said, and Ortiz started over with a bat. And Turner said, throw that bat down and I'll meet you halfway. He wasn't about to get out of that dugout with a guy with a bat in there. Well, all the rest of them too. I mean, all the other Puerto Ricans, or Venezuelans, or mm-hmm.
Where, Cubans,
whatever. And so they, when we got on there, they squared off and they was really fighting. And they let them fight for a little while. And the other, there's a couple of other scuffles too among the rest of us, but then it was minor. And then with Ellis Clary, who was another one of our characters, and he was right in the middle of it. And one of the umpires came out. He thought he was, the umpires before they dressed, you know, they wasn't dressed yet. They was doing batting practice. He kind of was going to stop it. Ellis Clary took him in the hand, gave him a flip, and pushed him. And then he found out he was an umpire. I think it was Weaver, one of the other umpires. Anyway, Ellis Clary got into it. Ellis was another one of our characters he wanted to talk to.
Mm-hmm. Did the teammates, I read something about maybe the Browns teammates were kind of secretly hoping that Turner would kind of get his butt whipped in this fight.
Well, not exactly. Like Turner was kind of a rough character. I mean, he didn't stay. He just came. I think they got him on waivers because I think Mancuso hurt his finger. We only had one catcher. And I think they got Turner to take his place. And he didn't stay. I mean, he wasn't there the full year. But Turner was kind of a, well, he